BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello. Today we're looking at nature writing. Is it simply beautiful words about beautiful things? Or is the power of communicating about nature, its diversity, beauty and importance, part of making us care enough to examine our actions and inactions, part of saving what we have and improving the legacy we leave behind? Well, I'm Charlotte Smith, usually found much, much earlier in the day here on BBC Radio 4, talking about food and farming, or wandering the UK for BBC One's Countryfile. After 3 years, I've just stepped down as the chair of the judging panel for a Nature Writing Prize, the Wainwright Prize for writing on global conservation.
One reason why our natural world is so rich comes from its geology, amongst the most varied to be found anywhere on the planet. From the chalk cliffs and downs of southern England to the limestone pavements of Yorkshire. From the rugged whinstone cliffs of Durham to the volcanic basalt of the Giant's Causeway in Northern Ireland.
Sir David Attenborough. His Wild Isles TV series has dominated many a Sunday evening. And there is, of course, a book to accompany the series. Well, for our discussion today, I'm surrounded by people who write about nature. Helen MacDonald, Paul Evans and Dr. Kerry Andrews. Welcome all. Let's start with Wild Isles. It obviously has this amazing visual impact. But what about the words? How important are they in framing those stories? It wouldn't be the same without them, would it, Paul?
It wouldn't be the same without them. And I think there's a bit of a problem with it myself. It's very much still about nature, red in tooth and claw, and the music swings between, you know, a sort of posh soap opera and something darkly Wagnerian. And what that does is to set a kind of an atmosphere for the words. And although Sir David Attenborough is everybody's favourite presenter, I'd just like him to be let loose a bit more, because I think his more conversational style, the wealth of his experience comes out when he's not so scripted, as if, you know, these are the 8 things that you've got to say about this species. And one of them is that there's hardly any of them left. And all those things are fair enough. But I think as far as a TV documentary goes, it's great. It opens windows for people into the lives of the more than human. And that's such a valuable thing. But as far as the words are concerned, I just have a few problems with it.
Kerry, what do you make of it?
I think it's absolutely phenomenal to get that lavish treatment given to nature in Britain with the full weight of a BBC wildlife documentary. I certainly have found myself gasping in the ways that I remember gasping at things happening on the Serengeti. So I think there is, I absolutely take Paul's reservations, but I think in some ways that just the fact that the British Isles are being given that wild treatment, I think that's doing some important things for how we appreciate nature in this country.
Helen.
Agreed. Yeah, David Attenborough, Sir David. I mean, yes, as a child, I was the small weird kid glued to the sofa when Life on Earth was on, and he became the voice of the expert. He knew everything. And I think this expert voice of the commentator, of the nature writer, is something that it's very easy to fall into. In fact, I've done some documentaries and I used to get told off all the time by the directors, stop doing Attenborough. You know, you can't help it. You start apostrophizing the tones. So I think one of the things my work tries to do is to think about, do you need to be an expert to interact with nature? How important is that voice? Is that voice missing stuff out? What is it not telling you about the way we relate to the natural world? And that's not to say I don't adore that voice. And these programs have such reach and such power that I can't get cross with them in any way. They're great big productions, and there's a place for them as there is a place for all kinds of nature writing.
I want to pick up on some of the things you've mentioned there a little bit later, because I'm aware we haven't heard any of your writing, and I think that would be good to sort of explain where you're all coming from. Let's start with you, Helen. You're most famous for H is for Hawk. There's also Vespa Flights. For people who haven't found your work yet, what do you write about?
Oh, so what I try and do is, first of all, just try and articulate the wonder and astonishment that I feel when I'm out and I see things. But the other thing I do, and this comes from my background as a historian of science, is to try and unpick the kinds of human meanings that we push into nature. We're all taught that nature is the one place free of human meaning, but actually it's where we store our deepest kind of cultural and social concerns. So, you know, it's why we value some habitats and creatures more than others. And it has real conservation kind of, you know, knock-on effects in terms of how we value these things. So this sort of correlation between natural and national history is my real, I think, my deepest subject.
Let's hear. Could you read us a bit?
Yeah, I'm going to read a little bit about the astonishment, the sort of transcendental kind of joy or transcendent joy of watching a young swift that was reared by a friend of mine from an orphan chick and letting it go. Nothing has visibly changed, but something is happening, like an aircraft avionics system coming online as it powers up. Blinking lights, engine check, check. But that doesn't work, though, not quite as an analogy, because what I'm watching is a new thing making itself out of something else. There is no doubt in my mind that this is as much a transformation as a dragonfly larva crawling from water and tearing itself out into a thing with wings. On my open palm, a creature whose home has been paper towels and plastic boxes is turning into a different creature whose home is thousands of miles of air. Then the swift decides. It tilts the pug-sharp, tiny tip of its beak upwards, arches its back and drops from my flattened palm, making an aching series of stiff and creaky wing beats. For 5 or 6 seconds, everything feels wrong. The bird is a mere foot above the grass and my heart is beating fast. Up, 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 I call. Nothing is broken. Just watching a bird learning to fly. Hitching, as if pulling into gear, the swift starts to ascend, flickering up and up into a sky streaked with evening cirrus. It describes one careful circle above our heads, then lifts even higher and straight lines it to the south. I look down at my palm. There's a little scratch on the meat of my thumb where its claws had gripped tight before letting me go. Gripped tight to the hand that was the last solid thing the bird would touch for years.
That's just beautiful. Paul Evans has written Field Notes from the Edge, How to See Nature, amongst others. You also write shorter pieces, like The Guardian's Country Diary. Different skills?
I don't know. To me, nature writing is not a noun. It's an argument. I really think of it as nature, comma, writing. And I think the argument is, what is nature? And how the hell can you write it at a time of ecological collapse? And if all the time you say, these things are wonderful, but they're all, you know, it's all going to hell in a handcart. There's a limit to the number of times you can actually say that. So my work is about encounter, what I learn and what I experience from the encounter, and then and maybe what good am I then? And then how you articulate that. And I just struggle all the time.
Elegantly struggling, I would say, having read it. Can you share some with us? What are you going to read from? You've got piles of books around us here today.
It's from How to See Nature. There's a little sort of bestiary at the end, and the last one is Zooplankton. And it's about jellyfish. Rhizostoma pulmo, or R. octopus, is the largest jellyfish in British waters. It can grow to nearly 90 centimetres in diameter, and is harvested around Wales for high-value medical-grade collagen. Jellyfish are boneless, brainless and heartless, and have drifted on ocean currents for 500 million years, pulsing gently towards landfall with the same kind of trusting faith as Dark Age mystics who set themselves adrift seeking divine grace. There are 50 or so washed up along a mile of the beach. Some are upside down, showing off frilly, translucent pantaloons of tentacles. Others are the right way up, looking like in vitro flowers on Victorian graves. Others are half-folded, resigned to this contortion without struggle. Jellyfish are the largest of the zooplankton in the seas around these islands, part of a life swarm, mostly invisible, sometimes luminous, and essential to sustaining the oceans. They are a floating word. Planktos in Greek means errant, meaning travelling in search of adventure, a wanderer or drifter of the waters.
Just wonderful, isn't it? Mm. Dr. Kerry Andrews, who's joining us from Peebles, you've written Wanderers, A History of Women Walking, and you've got a book about Nan Shepherd out soon. We'll explain exactly who she is later on. What drew you to this sort of genre?
I'm afraid to say I think I'm a bit of a fraud in comparison to Helen and Paul, whose writing about nature is so delightful. I've sat here enchanted. I'm moving more into writing about nature, but what I've been doing really is, I guess, correcting the historical record about the contributions made by women in particular to documenting their experiences. So I'm afraid to say I don't feel like I belong in the company of these nature writers in the same way.
No, I'm butting in here because I just want to yell and say, what are you talking about? Of course you're here. Of course you're at the table. There's no sort of sense. You know, we have to, as you know, fight against that sense that nature writing is the distant voice of the expert, you know, pointing out a plant and saying, aren't you lucky to have me to explain this to you? You know, this is, you know, you're very much with us here.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know where this definition of what nature writing is supposed to be comes from, but I think all of us are desperately trying to subvert it because we don't... It can get a bit hidebound, you know, if you're not careful.
Kerry, give us an extract.
So what I'm going to read for you is something that I'm writing in a work in progress that's about walking and motherhood. I finally learned to have my son's day bag on my back before I open the car door. F has no patience for my sense of parental responsibility, and I know that as soon as I release him from his car seat, he will be off down the path into the woods. He helps me get his arms clear of the straps. He knows perfectly well where we are, and he is keen to be away. Sure enough, he sets off at a run, and I follow him, laughing. He is so fast. As I gallop after him, all windmilling arms and laughter, I remember the changes this path has witnessed in the last 3 months. In early spring, my son had barely started walking. Hesitant about his balance, he held my hand as he toddled, and he tired after a few dozen yards. I carried him through the woods. As he grew in confidence and let go of my hands, I started to show him what lived by the path. I gently pressed his fingers into the soft bristles of the mosses growing on the collapsed dry-stained dike that seems to be made more of vegetation than stone. F and I took turns caressing the spring's leaf buds that were variously smooth, sticky, dry, pointy. We started touching the bark of the trees we encountered, talking about the different textures. F seems to prefer the rough segmentation of pine bark, taking pleasure in the way it snags his fingers. My favourite has long been the cold, near smoothness of the beech, and I delight in running my fingers across a beech tree as I might the skin of a lover. It doesn't take long for F to find things for himself, and our walks down the path are for a time interrupted by his frequent pauses to pick up the pine cones that fall from far above. When the goat willows start dropping their implausibly fluffy catkins onto the path, my son runs to each in turn, caressing the softness of their golden stamens before secreting them in the dry stained dyke's nooks, making of the wall a reliquary to the trees.
Wow. Brilliant. So beautiful.
Yeah, really lovely.
Yeah. Why do you write it? Are you trying to entertain, or are you actually trying to change the world?
I think I'm just a pretentious old beatnik, and I think and I actually think that writing is resistance. Yes, I want to change the world. I want to bear witness. I want to celebrate the misunderstood and the overlooked. I want to stand up for nature rather than standing in. I want to stand up for it, to be an advocate.
This phrase you used, bearing witness, I think is incredibly important. There's a line by the great British novelist Henry Green, and he was writing his autobiography before the Second World War because he thought he was going to die in it. And he wrote, we who may not have time to write anything else must do what we can. We should be taking stock. And, you know, we're living in the sixth rate extinction. And a lot of nature writers are my age and above. And we remember, you know, in our own lifetimes, I was born in 1970, we've lost, you know, nearly 400 million birds from Europe. You know, insect populations are crashing. It's just terrifying. And I feel that taking stock and bearing witness is very much part of what I do.
I just want to pick up on something we've sort of talked around. It's about who writes about nature and who reads it. Is it fundamentally privileged white people, mainly men, writing for a similar audience?
It has been. But thank the Lord, it's less that now. Slowly, it's getting better. some of my favourite writers over the last 5-10 years, people of colour, trans people, queer people, the whole kind of delimiting of that is an occasion of joy. And, you know, the sense that nature is a various place and the ways we interact with it are various, and there's no right way to do it. You know, it belongs to all of us, and that sounds terribly utopian, but, you know, things are still grim. The countryside in Britain is still very, very white. But in terms of voices and new voices, I think in America, J. Drew Lanham, for example, who wrote an astonishing book called Home Place, part of it is about what it's like to be a black ornithologist and birdwatcher. So many new voices that are genuinely thrilling.
I think I share Helen's assessment that it has been terribly white and terribly male. And I think for me, Kathleen Jamie's wonderful skewering of that demographic with the lone enraptured male is what really reverberates. And while I think Helen's absolutely right, there is an enormous amount of very interesting work being done, I do think there remains a difficulty when we're trying to get books agented and when we're trying to get books to publishers and we want publishers to take a risk on new things. I think that's the part where things still struggle.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that we could perhaps do with is these more privileged writers to do is say, I also have childcare responsibilities. I am also only able to get out into my local woodlands at the moment because I am sleep deprived and I have two small children at home. Or I am only able to get out to this part of the country because my access is restricted because I am not upper class. I think we need those restrictions to be articulated by those with more power so that it is not constantly the already less able who then end up sounding like they've got special pleading. I think we all need to, as a writing community, I think there needs to be more weight carried by those better able to bear it in order to create the space for these new voices to come in.
I agree entirely. The last, I don't know, 10 years of my life has really been about trying to do something about that within creative writing education. I mean, you know, here I am, lone enraptured male with my lone enraptured dog. Lone enraptured kids.
You're not wearing any tweed, though, Paul.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's warm.
You're wearing corduroy. There you go, then.
No. but it's true. And it's been a sort of a characterisation of what nature writing is that comes from natural history and from traditional countryside writing and the pastoral. And that thing has changed so much. You know, you've got some really interesting things happening, like people like Anita Sethi, who is racially abused on a train. You know, go back to where you come from. Of course, she's from Manchester. So what is this land? You know, what is this place that she's come from? So she writes this great book about her walk down the Pennines. She calls that nature writing. I call that nature writing. I think this is, you know, Natasha Carhu, who grew up in grinding poverty in Cornwall, writing about her experiences in this wonderful place and all the terrible things that happened to her. And then she sets up this working class writers festival out of the nature writing that she's doing. And I think this is all great. This is all brilliant. And people from so many different backgrounds now are writing what they want to write.
I think this brings us to Nan Shepherd. Kerry, tell us about Nan Shepherd.
Nan Shepherd was a fairly ordinary woman in a lot of ways. She was born in Aberdeen in 1893 and was very bright, so was able to go to university. She excelled academically. And after university, she became a teacher of teachers. She worked at the Aberdeen Training Centre. In the early 1940s, we're not quite sure exactly when, she started working on what would become the Living Mountain, which is, if people have heard of Nan Shepherd, it'll probably be the Living Mountain that they've read, which is now celebrated as one of the most important pieces of nature writing our country has produced. But that evaluation of it is extremely recent. Only in the last decade or so has people seen that in the Living Mountain. Nan Shepherd herself struggled to find a publisher for it, and the manuscript got tucked away, left in a drawer. for more than 30 years until Shepherd herself effectively self-published it with Aberdeen University Press. And my understanding is that she gave away as many copies as she sold. And so for another 30 years after it had been published, it didn't receive much attention. So its status as one of the most important pieces of writing about the natural world is incredibly recent.
Can you read us some Nan Shepherd?
This loch lies at an altitude of some 2,300 feet, but its banks soar up for another 1,500. Indeed, farther, for Cairngorm and Ben McDewey may be said to be its banks. From the lower end of this mile and a half gash in the rock, exit is easy, but very long. One may go down by the Arn itself, through 10 miles as lonely and unvisited as anything in the Cairngorms, to Inchrory, or by easy enough watersheds passed into Strathnethy or Glenderry, or under the barns of Bynack to the Capelich water. But higher up the loch, there is no way out, save by scrambling up one or other of the burns that tumble from the heights, except that, above the shelter stone, a gap opens between the hills to Loch Etchikan, and here the scramble up is shorter. The inner end of this gash has been howked straight from the granite. As one looks up from below, the agents would appear mere splashes of water, whose force might be turned aside by a pair of hands. Yet above the precipices we have found in one of these burns pools deep enough to bathe in. The water that pours over these grim bastions carries no sediment of any kind in its precipitate fall, which seems indeed to distill and aerate the water so that the loch far below is sparkling clear. This narrow loch has never, I believe, been sounded. I know its depth, though not in feet.
That book is so beautiful and so intensely embodied as well, and the sort of hallucinatory sort of sense of, and it's so transporting too. It's not like, with some writers you read about their experiences and you feel that you're sort of hearing them tell you about the places that they've been, but with Nan Shepherd you feel you're there, and that's a very rare gift. And in terms of understanding and knowledge, you know, yes, you know, you need to be walking, and you need to be seeing. There's a great sort of metaphor for that T.H. White, a writer that I wrote a lot about, Natures for Hawks, said that, you know, knowing something is like reading something in a textbook, and you know what it is, but understanding is like the tug on your heart when you hook a salmon.
But
you know
that, is that actually the difference, that I can read that book, be utterly transported by it, but actually I won't have anything like the same experience unless I go to, in this case, the Cairngorms? Because actually there's no substitute, is there, for doing it?
I think with a rare writer like Nan Shepherd, it's as close as you can get. That hard-won knowledge is something that you can feel. It's a bizarre kind of like sense of kind of empathy as you read, that you can be transported. I mean, I don't know many writers who can do that, and she can. I don't
she
know
she can. And it's kind of the opposite of Wild Isles in a way, that you don't get this sort of sublime, imposing, terrifying image of the great mountains covered in snow. What you get is embodied experience. What you get is the being there. And you can conjure those pictures in ways that radio can do, you know, that TV can't. And again, in a way that a book can do. It's much more like reading a novel or reading poetry, and you suspend that disbelief about whether it's true or whether it's real or whether that's a real place or not. You're just absorbed by the experience. And what the language does is to transport you to this wherever.
It's just terrific. And I think when we've been talking about what we need to do with nature writing, what nature writing needs to do for us, I think one of the things that Shepherd does that's so helpful is make these kinds of landscapes accessible to people with all kinds of bodies. From some of the books that I've read have been so off-puttingly, this epic mountain that you could never hope to scale, or this vast landscape you could never hope to reach, that the way Shepherd talks about these inner places, these quiet places, we can all find those.
We're reaching the end, so I'm going to join two questions together in an inelegant way, because I'm aware that often on Questing the Earth, we're talking about more tangible things. We're talking about somebody who is using seaweed to develop a recyclable plastic, for instance. Can nature writing, either in its present form or however it may evolve, have that same impact in changing what we do, how we see our place in the wider world?
For me, absolutely. If we can't imagine it, then we can't make it. And I think that's where nature writing can be at its most powerful. It's a space to dream and to imagine. And it's also, as Paul and Helen have been talking about, a crucial space to bear witness so that we have that in-between uncertain state in which change becomes possible.
Helen?
Yeah. I mean, you know, look back at Rachel Carson and, you know, what the Silent Spring did. I mean, that was phenomenally influential. Aldo Leopold, you know, these books really do change readers, but also they can do real change. And I don't know. I mean, at the moment, the grief is you know, the real emotion we have to battle with. Aldo Leopold said that the penalty of an ecological education is to live alone in a world of wounds. And I think reading nature writing is a way of feeling not alone in that great horror that we're facing, and gives us some kind of sense of purchasing power to make a difference. So yeah, I mean, it's political. It's always political. You know, some nature writing is politically problematic for me. It reaches back to sort of nativism, but other nature writing is deeply subversive and extraordinary. And that's what I hope, you know, we're going to push going forward.
Well, I think you can ask the same question of what good is literature anyway? And what good of the art are the arts? What do we do? What is their role in a climate emergency? What is nature writing in a time of ecological collapse? And one of the things that I think we can be optimistic about is that whatever we do, we won't know the consequences of it for a long time. And we don't know how. I mean, maybe there are, you know, there are seminal works that are important to the development of different kinds of literature, and we have to be careful that these things don't become monuments. You know, that literature is a living activity and it's changing all the time. But what we do know is what happens if we don't do anything.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the more voices there are, the better. Doing a creative response.
Yeah.
To this absolutely ridiculously awful situation we've, you know, landed ourselves in.
Thank you all very much indeed. It's been a fascinating afternoon. That's Paul Evans, Helen McDonald and Dr. Kerry Andrews. Thank you.